hope you'd all join me in welcoming him to speak with.
Good afternoon. I'm very pleased to be back at this location. I came here, as some of you may remember, for a breakfast when I was ambassador in India. I think it was in late 2006. And we had a very kind of active breakfast out on the veranda there, which was an off-the-record session, which is what I thought I was doing again today. And I have no text. I'm going to speak very informally. And the purpose here today is really just to engage you and have some give and take by me making perhaps some semi-provocative remarks about recent developments, and then move from there. So I understand the format, and I'll try to stick with that. First of all, I wanted to begin by, and I often do this when I move around the world speaking with investors and others, remind people where we've come from. Because I started my career in the financial business in the late 1960s in the London market, when the euro bond market was first being formed and the euro currency markets were first unfolding. And that really marked the beginning of the period that we have lived under today, during which has evolved a global capital market of enormous size and of world coverage. And this has been an up and down process. It's had many, many different manifestations. And I won't go through all of those. There's no point in doing that at a meeting like this. But I think what's important is that over the years, as the barriers came down and deregulation occurred in a wide variety of leading countries, and we worked our way towards, under the impetus of a variety of different shocks and developments, towards the kind of open worldwide capital market that we have seen performing in recent years. I call it the 40-year model of global market development. And the reason it's successful is demonstrated to us in this present crisis by the fact that for the first time in history, the industrial democracies of the world have gone through a period of crisis and negative growth, but other parts of the world have continued to grow at a significant pace and a very wide spread basis. So it's important to remember, for example, that something like 50%+ of the people in this world live in countries that did not have a banking crisis, did not have a confidence crisis, and are instead adjusting to a shock that they have to make adjustments for with their economic policy to establish recovery and growth, which is a very different proposition than trying to recover from a banking crisis and a confidence crisis. If you were to go back to the Second World War, the period after the Second World War, and you were to be asked, you know, what did the Allies after that great war really want to have happen in the world? And you look at the institutions that were formed, the United Nations and the World Bank and the IMF and a variety of other global institutions that came into existence in the years after the Second World War, I think you could summarize it in one sentence if you had to, by simply saying that the consensus really was that we should try to spread freedom and prosperity more widely in the world. So here we are in the current situation, essentially in many ways having achieved that in very large measure. And that, to me, is a highly significant fact that we must bear in mind as we think about how to respond to the crisis. Because, as we've seen, the response in the United States and Europe in particular has been, on the political front, very sort of hostile, very punitive in its approach, and rather narrowly focused on the United States and the countries of Europe and Japan. Obsessed really with the effect of the crisis on those economies, and really not recognizing that over these years, with freer capital movement, freer trade movement, freer people movement, freer movement of technology, we have seen spread around the world capital and growth on a scale never before realized. I remember in my early days in the business, the only sources of capital to the developing world were either U.S. aid, Soviet aid, or World Bank money. There were no other sources of capital available. And today, of course, that's entirely transformed. The reason I mention this is because what has been happening in the United States and Europe in the early phases of the response to the crisis has been a sort of a knee-jerk reaction that we must strengthen regulation, even possibly try regulating risk out of the system almost, and that you know, we need to house more capital around our banking system, which means that more capital will be drawn back into national markets, which is where we came from in the first place, and that perhaps there's some risk of less free and liquid capital movement across borders. In fact, this has not happened because developing countries, emerging market countries that are growing and need capital have been able to continue accessing capital through markets as opposed to through the banking community, which continues to be in a very conservative mode. And this is important, but again, it could be destabilized by a number of different potential developments. For the United States and Europe, the crisis runs very, very deep. And I mentioned before a very hostile political response, an attitude of punishment, strong populistic views, and this focus, obsession almost, with regulation and how to improve, structure, extend, globalize regulation, even beyond the reach of sovereign nations. And it's been something very, very interesting to watch. Take, for example, the G20 meeting in Pittsburgh, which came up with a quote-unquote framework in which the governments were going to work together to extend common regulatory practices beyond national boundaries in the hope that there could be established a sort of world regulatory structure that would help us avoid a recurrence of this past crisis. And politicians often getting up and thumping the desk and saying, we must make sure that this never happens again. But the word "this" is never defined. Is it the last 2 years? Is it big bonuses? Is it derivatives? Or is it the whole of the 40-year model that we've been through, which has spread this new fresh air and growth throughout the world? Interestingly enough, after the framework agreement to work together was agreed and the Financial Stability Board was designated as the entity to carry forward this regulatory initiative, we saw what happened 2 days after the election in Massachusetts when the President of the United States got up and announced a modification of the American banking system, blowing the whole process in other countries out of the water with no notice. So you can see the limitations for the kind of dream of cross-border or global regulatory initiatives. The purpose of these remarks is not to say we don't need an improvement in regulation, or that we don't need stricter rules, or that we don't need better standards. We obviously do. And it's very, very important to recognize that the speed with which the phenomenon took place, and especially the excesses committed in recent years, were very serious issues. But it is important, I think, to understand the limitations we face in correcting and addressing these problems, the differences that still exist from one country to another that have to be overcome, and the limitations of an agenda for cross-border or extra-sovereign activities in this field. After all, in the United States of America, now some 18 months or so into the crisis, you have had what should have been perfect conditions for regulatory reform. Democratic majority in the Congress, a Democratic president in the White House, and probably 90% of the public in favor of doing things to limit, change, punish, reform, whatever, the financial system. And yet still, there has been no concrete achievement at this point. As to the response to the crisis, at least in the United States, we've seen a series of very, very strong stimulative actions, which obviously have had some effect because we see some growth recovery. But we have to recognize that there are real limitations on the ability of these packages to stimulate what you might call sustained growth recovery. And perhaps the strongest evidence of this is the fact that despite all the money going into the system, credit is not reaching small business, it is not reaching Main Street America. And therefore, as the exit strategies are exercised by the various authorities to return to normal and withdraw stimulation, one has to be very, very concerned about whether or not the economy is going to be able to, in a way, pick it up on its own momentum and go forward from here. I personally am extremely concerned about this, and I have grave doubts that we will see anything beyond a very modest and up and down recovery. Meanwhile, we have to accept another reality, and that is that despite the efforts of countries to meet and to discuss these issues, the G20 being the current group that has designated itself as the manager of the world economy, taking over from the G7, which I was deeply involved in when I was in the Treasury, this initiative has really not made any progress in the single most important challenge. Its focus has been on regulatory issues, bonuses, and tax havens. It has left the key issue of macroeconomic policy adjustment between nations, which is the essence of adjusting imbalances between nations, which are and have been a major part of the destabilizing forces at work these past years, it leaves them untouched. And therefore, also, as we recover, we need to keep in mind that the imbalances are going to reappear. They are not going to be addressed unless there's some remarkable change that we haven't seen yet. Finally, I'd like to come to the point of the effect of the crisis globally. Again, this is a work in progress. It's a very, very important issue, but one that one cannot be definitive about at this stage. But the shape of things to come is visible. And that is that the spread of growth that I mentioned, the capacity of countries that did not have a banking crisis, China, Korea, India, you know the list, these countries having now restored growth much more quickly than other countries, and having established a pattern of rising growth that really is almost duplicative of where they were before the crisis hit, means that as that growth projection for the recovering emerging market countries runs at a sort of angle like that, while Europe, the United States, and Japan continue to have a flat experience, this space that is opened between these two lines represents the shape, in my view at least, of the 21st century. Because the power shift that was happening before the crisis hit, of the movement of power and influence to Asia, is continuing and will accelerate. And if this pattern persists, as I believe it will, for the next 3, 4, 5 years, then you will see a most remarkable shift in global balance of power in our world. I mention this because what is interesting, what is very important to understand, is that the countries that are recovering, taken as a group, form a very large part of the world's population. They have large individual populations. They have large internal markets. They have large and aspiring, recently arrived middle classes who have no intention to go back to poverty to give the West time to sort its problems out. And they have for the most part, at least India-China, large standing militaries. They are societies that are very, very keen on education, that put a high priority on technology, both in the civilian world and in the military sector. And yet they all have one thing in common, and that is that they are all individually and as a group underrepresented in the institutions of global economic and financial governance. This is a situation which really cannot persist, but it will persist and has persisted longer than it should have done already. So you will not see reform in the IMF and the World Bank anytime soon. So you will have to look for a different kind of expression of power. And this is the reason why I say the form is visible, the actual structure of how things unfold is really yet to be seen, because it's still something that is happening. As you know, I spent 5 years in India, and during this time, there was the most remarkable transformation of the U.S.-India bilateral relationship and relationship between the two nations in many, many ways. And I spoke about that in the 2006 when I was here. But there was also another factor, and that was that there was an equally large emphasis given by President Bush to the U.S. relationship with China. And in fact, much is lost in the assessment of Mr. Bush by virtue of the fact of adventures in the Middle East, in Iraq, and elsewhere, which generated all sorts of hostility and views of adversity for him. But in his diplomacy of China and India, which together form a very large part of the future of the world's population, George W. Bush really understood that power had shifted already to Asia. He was the first president, and I've worked for five presidents, who really understood that that phenomenon was underway and it had to be addressed, and therefore he had an extremely high priority, which was less visible to the outside world than it was to those of us who worked in with him, to both China and the U.S. as key future relationships for the United States. So the change that we saw, I mean, for example, the Indian mission, the U.S. mission in India during my 5 years there, became the largest mission in the American system. That surprises people. Also the most diverse in terms of the number of agencies and departments represented in that mission. So the U.S.-India interface was multifaceted, covering virtually every area of human endeavor that you can name. And of course, that is still going on. Likewise, China, very broad relationship. So these were signs of the times, and the crisis has, in a way, tested the system, shown that the growth that was established around the world can be sustained, at least for now, is being sustained, and that the recovery path is going to change our lives. Thank you. I'd be happy to take questions.
Anyone's got questions for Ambassador Mulford, please raise your hands.
Ambassador, could you talk a little about the U.S.-India nuclear accord? First, of course, this was an historic change in U.S. policy. Could you talk about the dreams that both the U.S. and the Indian side had going into the transformation, and how has the reality played out?
Well, thank you for that question. That's close to my heart, that one, because I spent almost four years negotiating the agreement, which was a bilateral negotiation, but also coupled with a global implementation negotiation. And again, it's an important piece of evidence of the view of George Bush, which was that he believed that it was necessary for the United States in its relationship with India to face how one assisted India to move towards its vision of becoming a major world economy. There were really three major constraints on that. One was India's lack of infrastructure, The second was the need to diversify its energy base. And the third is the sort of transformation of India's rural economy. So those are the three major constraints on India's ability to get where it's going. And the decision was made that we would take an initiative in the energy field. First of all, for a year's time, we spent our energies negotiating away the debris of the period of sanctions from 1998, which didn't require legislation, but did require a lot of negotiation because there were all kinds of licensing requirements and other bureaucratic impediments to high-tech trade. This took about a year. We moved from the point where 26% of items in those categories needed a license to the end of the year when only 1% did. Then George Bush decided that we needed to face this question of India's isolation in the world of civil nuclear commerce. I think you all know that India was not a signatory of the 1974 Non-Proliferation Treaty, and everybody else was. And the countries that signed that treaty, apart from the big five nuclear powers, all agreed to forego nuclear weapons and in return then to have access to civil nuclear commerce technology for their development of their own energy industries. So India comes along. It has in the meantime developed its own nuclear weapons on its own bottom without proliferation in or out. And it has a sophisticated scientific community which has done this. And therefore, Bush's view was we need to accept de facto that this is the reality. We will never get India to put those back in the bottle as long as China and Pakistan have nuclear weapons. So we have to live with that. But what we better do is not leave one-sixth of humanity outside the system. So he stood up against the entire non-proliferation community in the United States government, in all the various departments you're aware of, you know, which is an extremely entrenched committed community, because it required a change in U.S. law to undertake this initiative. The Atomic Energy Act of 1954 had to be amended. This required a vote in each House of Congress, and it required, in the way we did this, votes of that type twice, one in 06 and the other in October of 08. And during that time, we negotiated, first of all, a separation agreement with India on the separation of its civil and nuclear programs, so that when we moved forward, safeguards, international safeguards, which applied to nothing in India up to then, could be extended to the civil nuclear program. And in the end, after a few years, safeguards would be applied to about 70% of India's reactor population, and later would go to 90%. But we had to agree, accept de facto, without formal recognition, India's nuclear weapons. We then had to negotiate what's called a 1-2-3 agreement, which is the mechanism by which cooperation in this field is instituted between India and the United States bilaterally. That was a very complicated agreement. It took a long time to do. Those had to be shown to the Congress before the vote. They had to be approved. They were, and the Congress, despite being in a period of bitter partisan division, voted with massive bipartisan majorities in both the House and the Senate to move forward. Then we moved to the point where India had to go to the IAEA to effect its agreement there and to negotiate its own safeguard agreement. It was paralyzed for 11 months by domestic politics in doing that, and then moved forward, and we managed to get that done, and then we had to go to the 45-nation nuclear suppliers group of countries, i.e. all the countries that had signed the treaty. And you can imagine a lot of big countries in there, their view was, you know, we played by the rules, we signed the agreement, we didn't develop nuclear weapons, now these guys come along, they never played by the rules, they never signed, and they get to be a single exception in the world. That took some diplomacy to get around that, but we eventually did that, and there was, that had to be a uniform 100% consensus agreement to change the rule. That was finally accomplished, and then go back to the Congress for votes. And we won those again in a time of bitter partisanship, even worse than the first time, by very large majorities. Then India had to look at how to implement this, and this is going on now. It'll be a long process. Their aim is to raise dependence on civil for electricity from 2.5% today to 20% in 18 years. This will require approximately 50 1,000 megawatt reactors, which is an investment in excess of $100 billion. And it still has to be, of course, effected. They have taken the first steps by designating for various countries nuclear parks and announcing those where reactor facilities will be built by France, Russia, and the United States. And the local industry in India is gearing up to take part in the building process. But there's lots of work to be done. There's still a liability issue that has to be sorted out with legislation in India. And there is a special negotiation still going on whereby a provision that was agreed to provide India up front with the right to reprocess spent fuel has to be negotiated and completed by August this year. That is a novel aspect of this deal so that India can reprocess spent fuel in country, and that would be a step forward for all of us if they can manage to do that. So that's where it stands. There's a lot of interest on the part of the Russians, the Germans, the French, the United States, the Japanese, and my view is that we won't see much activity for 2 years, and then the process will get off the ground and start moving. Sorry for the long answer, but that's the story. Yes.
The treatment of foreign exchange rates by the countries of India and China are different. I was just wondering if that affected what you believe to be the shift in the balance of power for those countries.
The way in which they manage exchange rates?
Yes.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question. I don't think it's the key issue, but I think it's an important issue. The Indians, of course, matter less because they have less reserves and they have a different kind of economy than China. Their economy is not as export dependent. It has a stronger domestic growth base, whereas China follows this highly aggressive model of high growth, high employment, and a managed exchange rate. And in return for that, it accepts a depreciation of the value of its foreign assets. It's not a reportable thing in China. It doesn't have any political meaning, and therefore they can accept this, which would be hard to do in a democracy because, you know, your family jewels are being depreciated in return for this type of model. And the reason imbalances are not going to improve is that China appears to be ready to start that engine up again against much more hostility this time in the world, and it's really hard to read how that will come out. But what they are not doing, and what the United States is not engaged as they should be with China on, are the negotiations about macroeconomic policy changes over time that transform the structure of the Chinese economy to a stronger domestic-led investment economy, stronger consumption, because these developments pose certain uncertainties in a country which has monolithic governmental control, a market economy that requires increasing degrees of personal freedom, and personal freedom, not in a civil rights sense, but in an economic decision sense, would be required if you expand your domestic economic base with stronger consumption and investment and so on. So, this is an extremely serious problem for the recovery. India, on the other hand, has followed a foreign exchange policy which has permitted the currency to move in what you might call a managed float. During my years there, it moved from sort of 51 to 38 rupees per dollar, which is a very significant spread when you think about it. And it moved in that range several times back and forth. It sort of hovered around 46, 47, 45, but it did break in different directions at different times. I don't think the United States Treasury ever gave India credit as a contrast to Beijing for that policy. Had I still been at the Treasury, I would have done that. But it does seem too bad they didn't give it more recognition. But in fact, it is quite different.
Just a question over here.
Yes. 14, 15 months during the midst of the crisis, there was a lot more. There was a lot of talk about a Bretton Woods II type or discussion. That died down, and as you mentioned, the G20 is focused on regulatory bonuses and things like that. Do you, what caused that kind of Bretton Woods II discussion to die down, and do you see that picking back up, and what would lead us to a Bretton Woods II type international negotiation over balance of payments, debtor-creditor nation type discussion?
Do you mean by Bretton Woods II a restructuring of the sort of ownership in the institutions?
Well, that's part of it, but that's more the manifestation rather than more, as you were saying earlier, discussions about macro imbalances and trying to negotiate between the major debtor and creditor countries over macro policies.
Well, my own view is there's a watershed issue here, and that is that unless you find a way to restructure the IMF and the World Bank, Bretton Woods institutions, to reflect the change in power, because China and India each have share positions or quota positions, as they're called, equal to or less than Belgium. And I love to point out all the time that, you know, there are more handset sales in India in a month than most European countries have for a population. So what is going on here? As these countries grow and their economies increase, these issues, these institutions are frozen in the past. And therefore, their credibility to institute the kind of appraisals and negotiations on policy is distinctly limited in these countries, which really don't pay much attention to the IMF. The IMF's lost a whole lot of credibility and influence, in part because it's no longer representative. Now, we see it making a comeback in these troubled times here and there with countries that are strapped. And most recently, you know, there's this debate in Europe, and I didn't mention the fact that, you know, this current situation is going to be to some extent significantly influenced by what happens to the euro and the European community and the sort of the cohesion of the European vision, because Greece and the other countries with difficulties pose a real threat to the stability and inclusiveness of the EU. As you can already see, the euro has lost its image that it might have some claim to be a alternative reserve currency for the world. I don't imagine countries like China and Saudi Arabia are really looking at it anymore. It's seen as a more of a high-risk currency, depending upon what a small country like Greece happens to be doing. So, and there's another 7 or 8 future Greeces waiting in Eastern Europe to join the system. So it's really very hard to see how they're going to make you know, this thing work. And the IMF is being considered as a possible entity to address Greece's problems, but that is a very hard pill to swallow for a group that sees them as themselves as a sovereign group of nations, to have the IMF come in and deal with, like it would be the IMF would go to California and sort of talk to the governor out there about what he should do and shouldn't do. That wouldn't go over very well, wouldn't really be possible. But, and of course, it's not quite the same situation, but it's similar enough to be comparable. So I think the institutions will stay unreformed for some long while, and that these countries will go their own way and find ways, maybe within the G20, to create working coalitions of smaller groups that take initiatives to do things and then get them, in a way, blessed by the bigger G20 group. But again, I don't know if that can be done or not. I know a lot about how you get policy changes done, and I know that if you get more than 20 people in the room, you've got a real problem. And if you've got secretariats and secretaries, note-takers, communiques, and all that, you've got an even bigger problem. This is very, very difficult stuff that has to be worked out between principals on an informal basis.
Tom, Ambassador, you very eloquently described that gap between the China-India growth curve and that of the U.S. and Europe as the shape of the 21st century. And if this were to continue for another 3, 4, 5 years, the impact would be tremendous. my reaction to that was only 3, 4, 5 years. How confident are you that will be the shape of things to come for another 30, 40, 50 years? Or is there a real danger that China's, in particular, China's unwillingness to embrace political reform will jeopardize its current very positive trajectory?
Well, I didn't go further than 5 years for that reason, because nobody can know what's going to happen in these things. But what is true is that if this spread is maintained for a period of a few years, the changes will be significant enough to matter politically. You could almost say that in the last 18 months, the rise of respect, interest, and so on in China and India as future global players of key importance has risen very significantly. India more than China, because China was in a way already very significantly there. But, you know, this group of nations, it isn't just the two, it's a variety of countries, including Korea and Brazil and others, and Russia for that matter, they pose a major transformation potential. Now, a lot of things could happen that would affect those lines. When it comes to Europe, I don't have any confidence whatsoever that Europe will be a quote-unquote growth area. I think growth in Europe will be flat, and I think that Europe has become a benefits preoccupied society, does not really want to pay the price of going for growth, and it has all sorts of social, internal social problems, which we don't need to go through here, but you must surely be aware of, that don't spell a long-term happy future for Europe. In the United States, which has been the engine of the global economy, the answer to your question is in a way deeply political, because if the United States is going to have, you know, a massive healthcare entitlement, which we now seem to have, if it's going to have a heavily taxed future, if it is going to have more and more government intervention, possibly a rising protectionism that will be motivated by job losses and by trying to protect American markets and workers, I don't see the basis for a U.S. recovery that's really buoyant. I do believe the United States, unlike any other country, can remake itself more quickly than most. And this has been done in the past, most recently in the 80s and in the 90s, after the Carter years. I mean, between Reagan, Bush, and Bill Clinton, you look at a pretty exciting period of growth and so on over a period of 20 years. Obviously, there were a few problems, but it was a very significant period. It's hard to look forward when you see the indebtedness that is projected for the United States. The challenges that present to the American people, for the first time, finding that foreign holders of their debt really, in a sense, strongly influence domestic interest rates and growth levels in the United States, and the capacity to generate incentive, creativity, entrepreneurship, hamstrung by heavy government intervention, intrusive and heavy tax burdens, and so on, all maybe for good reasons, depending on your point of view, but I don't think you can avoid the effect being that a buoyant recovery of the United States seems to be pretty unlikely. Maybe we'll have a second dip, maybe we'll just have a very flat period, but the recovery over a period of years is going to be slow. Credit is not in Main Street. Credit is not in small businesses. That's where jobs are created. The mortgage market is still a completely unsolved problem. The overhang of houses, the suffering of American people, which is really, you know, a significant new dimension, not properly understood at all in Washington, is something that is going to take some time to correct. So I think for 3 or 4 years, these patterns are going to play, unless China overplays its hand and there's some kind of a protectionist response. that upsets everything, or other things go wrong, or regulation moves to a point where it shuts down cross-border capital movement in significant ways. I mean, there's all kinds of things that can happen, but I think the early part of this is pretty clear, and my own belief is that this change is fundamental. This is a long-term change. I'm not saying that these countries take over the world. I'm saying they are going to be the players. And if there was a new G7, it would be made up of the U.S. and Japan and China and these other players until you get to six or seven nations, and it won't be the old leading nations.
We've probably got time for one last question, I'd say. Yep. Gentleman down here.
Just your description shift of... I wanted to apply that to the current spat over the yuan exchange rate between the U.S. and China. Do you think that other stakeholders in Asia will actually align themselves with China in this spat over the exchange rate?
You mean align themselves with China to maintain its present rigidities? I don't see why they would. I think the China policy is going to have to change, and I'm just not sure how it's going to change, what will bring that change about. What's obvious is that sending the Secretary of the United States Treasury out to browbeat them to appreciate their currency is not a sufficient policy. And I found the same thing in the 80s when we were addressing at the Treasury. You maybe remember the Plaza Accord, the Louvre Accord, and the adjustments of that period when the dollar was excessively strong. We engaged in deep, deep discussions about a whole variety of policy issues that would, if they could do them politically, would help strengthen domestic demand in China and in Germany at that time, the surplus countries. And those were very tough discussions. There are very deep political issues there. But it isn't just about exchange rates. It is about macro, fundamental macroeconomic policies. And as I tried to say earlier, China has to face this. I mean, if it wants to restart the old engine and take its chances, that's one option. Or it can look into itself and see how it can change its economic model in ways that it can accommodate. The role of its partners should be to discuss, assist, help with ideas, give assurances, try to help a better understanding of what's involved in these things to help effect the underlying change necessary to permit a more flexible exchange regime. It doesn't work the other way around, cramming it down from above. This is a very, very key issue. And just so we're clear, I see you writing notes over there. In 1988, the United States Congress passed legislation. I was Under Secretary of the Treasury at the time. That legislation said, because we had an imbalance problem and we faced a rising force of protectionism in the United States Congress, which was seeking to pass an omnibus trade bill that would do the same sort of things people are talking about today. That legislation said that any country that built up a sudden surplus with the United States and did not have a surplus with the rest of the world, generally, had to be engaged because it might be manipulating its currency to achieve this result. Because, and the result would be felt in the U.S. accounts, because the United States was such an open economy, it didn't have any barriers. So, by law, the Undersecretary, the Secretary of the Treasury, are required to engage those countries. I first had to do this, not with China, but with Korea and Taiwan, even with Hong Kong a bit, surprisingly, and Singapore, I remember, whose currencies seemed not to be as flexible as necessary. And the Congress requires a report from the Treasury twice a year in which an assessment of each country in this shape and condition is made as to whether or not they are, quote-unquote, manipulating their currency. As far as I can remember, there has never been a manipulation judgment passed in that report to the Congress, because it's a very serious and politically explosive thing. But they're very close to requiring it today. And this report is due April 15th. It will have to be tabled in the United States Congress, and then there will have to be testimony by the Treasury to defend, you know, why it hasn't labeled the situation as manipulation, or why on earth it did it. I mean, it depends on your point of view. So this is a very ticklish moment, and this explains a lot of what's going on at the moment, the heat and sort of light that you see being generated. But it's a very real thing, because it is by law in the United States a necessity. And the Congress takes the view that if the currency manipulation accusation is sustained by the Treasury, then the Congress would be right to impose sanctions, trade sanctions, on the country that is manipulating its currency. So we're approaching another one of these very touchy moments. And I don't frankly know how it'll come out. But that's how it happens. And you know, these are very, very, very difficult decisions. Anything else?
I think that's probably all we've got time for right now. Ambassador.
Okay.
But I think you'll all join me in thanking Ambassador Mulford today. It was a very insightful and good analysis of what's going on at the moment. Cheers.
Thank you.
And as always, we've got a...